Trials is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Donnelly, Judge Baitis, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. We have six cases on our calendar for today. Three are set for oral argument. The first is which is A20-0469, Minnesota Voters Alliance et al. Versus State of Minnesota and Secretary of State Stephen Simon. We will have oral arguments by appellant for 15 minutes and then 15 minutes by respondent and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. Just to check, to make sure that both parties, we can hear you okay. Mr. Erickson, can you please speak up?
Can anyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Mr. Hartshorn, can you speak up, please?
Good morning, Your Honors. Long time no see.
Yes, it has been a while, hasn't it? A whole week. Good to see you both. Just as a matter of logistics, we are holding these oral arguments virtually via Zoom. If for some reason we run into any technical difficulties, we will make sure we make appropriate adjustments so that each of you have the appropriate amount of time for your arguments. You will see the timer in the screen displaying how much time you will have left. We know from the arguments from last week on a similar case that these are very, very important issues. And if we do run over, we will make accommodations so it is fair for both sides. And with that, counsel for petitioners, you may begin. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's Gregory Erickson from Moorman, Cardall & Erickson on behalf of petitioners, Minnesota Voters Alliance, Mary Franzen, Cindy Pugh, Dwayne Quam, and Eric Lucero. Eric Cardall couldn't be with us today. May it please the court. The Minnesota Supreme Court has ruled that in Minnesota, voting by absentee ballot is a right and not a privilege. And that's Bell v. Ganaway, 227 Northwest 2nd, 797. The crux of petitioner's Rule 8210.0225 challenge is that under the Secretary's rule, the voter challenge requirements for Election Day and absentee voting in Minnesota are different. In Election Day voting, numerous questions are asked. First of all, the voter is notified of the challenge. And second, numerous questions are asked under oath to the challenged voter with follow-up questions answered to the election judge prior to the issuance of the ballot to the voter.
And counsel, just to be clear, in terms of when we're talking about the difference between the two, those two are governed by different statutes, correct?
That is correct.
So the statute governing same day voting is chapter 204C, correct?
That is correct.
And the statute governing absentee balloting is governed by 203B, correct?
That is correct. But okay. I must note that in, there is a section of in 203B.001, okay, Your Honor, it states that the Minnesota election law is applicable to voting by absentee ballot unless otherwise provided in this chapter. So Judge Reyes, what that says is that the other provisions of Minnesota election law apply to absentee ballot voting unless the chapter says that they don't apply. So the main provision that we're talking about, 204C.12, the section that relates to how to deal to challenge voters, does apply to absentee ballot voting because the absentee ballot statute does not say that it does not apply.
Okay, but where in 204C.12 does it say that it applies to absentee balloting? Is there any language in that statute at all?
Your Honor, I think, with all due respect, I think you have it backwards.
Let me ask the question again. Does 204C.12 mention absentee balloting at all?
It mentions, first of all, let's just get the statute out and refer to it.
Well, let me cut to the chase. It does not refer to absentee balloting at all. And in fact, it refers to that is in the chapter that talks about same day election voting. And if you look at subdivision 4, which is not referenced in your brief at all, it talks about what needs to be done with respect to a challenged individual who leaves the polling place. So it makes it very, very clear that this statute refers to same day voting.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. In 204C, there are many sections that are generally applicable to more than just election day voters, because if the only thing that applied to absentee balloting was 204B, then we'd be in a situation where there'd be a dearth of regulation over absentee balloting. Okay. There are, first of all, in 201.121, which is a generally applicable statute to both absentee and regular election day voting, it references in subdivision 2, an individual challenged in accordance with this subdivision shall comply with the provisions of 204C12 before being allowed to vote. And Judge Reyes, I would also direct your attention to statute section 204B.45. Okay, Your Honor? That's the statute that states that governs mail balloting for cities under 400 people that have elected to vote by mail balloting. Okay, in that particular statute, okay, it mirrors the election day requirements in 204C12 in the fact that those challenged voters in those districts that have elected to vote by mail under that statute, those voters are notified of their challenge, okay? They're notified of the challenge, and they are not provided the ballot unless and until they address that challenge.
Yes, so, and I'm glad you point that out, because that chapter, that section, I should say, 204B.45 subdivision 3 also talks about how a person that is challenged will receive instructions on how they may apply for an absentee ballot if they believe the registration was challenged in error. So that mail-in ballot provision actually allows for that person to receive an absentee ballot. Therefore, they would have to go to 204B in order to obtain that ballot, specifically subdivision 4. So the mail-in ballot provision that you cited in your brief on page 21 and 22 actually allows for a mail-in ballot, a person who is challenged with their mail-in ballot, to receive an absentee ballot. I want to ask a question before we go too much further down the road in terms of the merits, though. Standing. So for standing, you have to meet two prongs. The first prong is you need to show that there's a harm more than just the harm that the general public would suffer. The second part is you need to show that there is a harm that is more than just hypothetical or speculative. And when the first question I have is in this brief, you refer to fraud 7 times. Are there any allegations of fraud?
With respect to the election that just happened, or with respect in fraud in general?
That's for you to answer, because
okay, because Your Honor, the reports that we provided in our brief relating to the studies that were done on ineligible voters being allowed to vote in previous elections. First of all, I want to make it clear that the petitioners in this case are all are all representatives that have been elected or defeated by.
Can I just interrupt you there, Mr. Erickson, because there is one petitioner, Ms. Pugh, whose status I'm unclear about. In the brief, you had indicated that she was planning to run for office. Can you just fill us in on what happened with that plan and whether she did indeed run for office after being defeated in the last election?
No, Ms. Pugh did not end up running.
Okay, so she, what is her interest then? Could you please identify that for us, given that she was not a candidate?
She may run in the future, and in the future, she would like this rule to be repealed so that the elections are fair. Now, okay. Your Honor,
could you just explain then how her interest is any different than the interest of anyone in the public at large in the fairness of an election for the purpose of standing?
Okay, with respect to her, I would say she would be placed in the group of people that are intending to run, that may intend to run for office in the future. Okay, they are different than the normal person in the fact that when when the election occurs, the average person, and I would classify me as an average person, okay? When the election is over, no matter who wins, I go to work in the exact same place, okay? With respect to a candidate or someone who intends to be a candidate, if they prevail in the election, their job changes. They have the privilege of serving at the Capitol, okay? Or not serving at the Capitol, but wanting to. That is the particularized injury to either candidates themselves or people that want to eventually run for office in the future.
Okay, but Mr. Erickson, so when I read your brief, first of all, I just want to confirm, you're not alleging any fraud has taken place, any intentional acts. What you're arguing is that the alleged harm is if there are a significant number of ineligible voters who cast ballots, correct? You mentioned that several times throughout the brief.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. How is that not speculative? How is that not hypothetical? How is that tied to the rule? That's a very general statement.
Because it is a fact that has been proven that in previous elections, okay, ineligible voters have been allowed to vote and their votes have been counted.
And I want to stop you there too, Mr. Erickson, because I think you're, just to kind of continue the thought that you had earlier, I think you were referring to the voter registration 2018 examination report, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and when I read that report, it talks about numbers of people who, in terms of voting, but the report says that there's not any evidence of actual ineligible votes cast. It makes it very clear that report is not saying that they actually were?
Your Honor, we have had a previous case that has been litigated in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court in which we requested the information that would prove the ineligible status of these voters, and we were denied that information. Your Honor.
So that's not in the record at all. So you don't, and you, that information, even if you would have had it, you would have to show that it would somehow negatively affect petitioners. And there's not even any evidence of that either, correct?
Your Honor, my question, first of all, there is no evidence in the record of fraud, okay? But there's a difference between intentional fraud and somebody mistakenly believing because they haven't been subjected to questioning in their eligibility status. And for example, in election day voting, first of all, I direct your.
Can I just interrupt you? I just, practically speaking, since we're sort of turning to the practical implications here of what your complaint is, practically speaking, when someone is challenged at a polling place, they're asked a couple questions and they have to take an oath, right?
That is correct.
And under the rule that you're challenging, when a voter's status is challenged, they are sent a registration form, which requires the voter to take an oath and again certify their eligibility. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So let's be really clear here about what the specific concern is.
Okay. I'm happy to make that clear.
Yeah, what's the difference?
The specific concern, Your Honor, is that under the Secretary's rule, a registered voter, because anyone that shows up on the SVRS is a registered voter, is changed to a non-registered voter by the Secretary simply by virtue of their decision to vote absentee. And that's what we are challenging. Because, Your Honors, that, first of all, there's no authority for the Secretary to do that.
Well, let me step you there, Mr. Erickson, because the way I read that rule, and you're talking about Minnesota's administrative rule 82100.0225, it doesn't say that the person's status changes. It says that the process that is being used, the language says, quote, a person who applies for an absentee ballot, that the absentee ballot process must be administered as if the voter was not registered to vote, which refers back to 203B subdivision 4, that process. And in fact, the beginning of that language of that rule talks about a voter registration application must be sent with the ballot to any challenged voter whose voter registration application is incomplete. And then it refers to two statutes, one of which is 201.121 and 201.061. Under 201.061, it allows for four different ways. If you look at subdivision 3, it allows for at least four different ways that a person who is challenged can provide evidence that, for example, with respect to residency, to Judge Gaitis's point. And three of the ways are explicitly allow for that information to be sent in. Another way is same day voting when you have an oath taken. So I'm struggling to understand how that rule conflicts with the statutes regarding absentee ballots and how to address challenged your challenge status.
Okay, when you create two classes of people, okay?
Well, two classes of people are not created. It's just talking about the process that is used. It's not changing their status. It's still recognizing that they are they are being, that their status is being challenged. It talks about the absentee ballot process that is being used, that must be used in that situation.
Your Honor, let me hold that up against the process in election day registration. In election day registration, a voter can be denied a ballot, okay? There are situations where a voter can be denied a ballot if they don't properly resolve the challenge. Under the secretary's rule, the voter that relates to absentee voters in cities with greater than 400 people, absentee voters are never denied a ballot. Never.
Mr. Erickson, isn't it the case that it's under the statute that absentee voters are not denied a ballot, and that in fact the rule places some restrictions on absentee voters who have been challenged in order to cure any problems that may have arisen?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that the Secretary's Rule 8210225 cures the problem of a challenged voter receiving an absentee ballot.
What about my first question? And I apologize for asking sort of a compound question. Isn't your problem really with the statute and not the rule?
No, Your Honor, because the rule that should be applied to absentee voters in all circumstances is in 8210-3000, which states that no ballot should be mailed to any challenged voter unless and until they are notified of their challenge status and they resolve it. The problem that we have with the process that the secretary's rule creates is that the voter themselves is never notified of their challenged status. And that's what puts them in a different position than an election day voter and a absentee voter who's challenged in a city of less than 400 people. And that, to us, makes no sense to treat those voters differently. They should all... First of all,
I just wanted to follow up on your point. So then how would you have the statute work then?
I
take it you don't want them to get a new ballot. Is that a fair statement?
No, I don't want them to get a ballot until they've been notified of the challenge and they have made an effort to either resolve the challenge or to the satisfaction of the election representative, or choose to just vote on top of it. Yeah, first of all, in an election day voting, you're allowed to vote, okay? After you've been notified of the challenge and basically informed that this could be a problem for you if you vote and you are an ineligible voter and you are not qualified to vote. For example, if you're a felon, one of the problems that we have with the voter registration application being the thing to somehow get the voter, cure the
Before you go into that, Mr. Erickson, I just wanted to understand how it would work.
Oh.
So for example, okay, so you want them to be, you want the voter who requested an absentee ballot and there's problems with it, you want that person to get a separate notice from the Secretary of State saying their ballot has been challenged. Am I with you now?
A separate notice from their okay.
And then what would happen then under your version and interpretation of the statute? What would happen then?
What would happen is exactly what the legislature provided for cities of less than 400 people that have elected to vote by mail. It's the exact same structure that
I mean, okay, so let's say I've now gotten my notice of a challenge, my ballot's being challenged, the Secretary of State sent me a notice. What do I do then in order to vote?
You cure your challenged status under 204C12.
And how do I do that?
By providing information showing that the challenge, whether it be that you don't live in the jurisdiction, you send them a utility bill saying...
Would I do that by mail too, or do I have to personally show up at the...
You can do that by mail. It's done by mail in cities of less than 400 people. So that can be done by mail.
I think you just answered the question then, if it can be done by mail, that isn't that the absentee ballot process? Isn't that how you do it by mail?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that the process that is utilized in cities of less than 400 people under the statute, so the legislature has already fixed this issue that we are concerned about.
Right, but the mail-in ballot statute that you refer to actually allows for a person to request an absentee ballot.
After,
so I don't see how the rule then contradicts that statute. That statute allows somebody who has been challenged by a mail-in to actually request an absentee ballot. What's the problem?
It allows them to request an absentee ballot after they've been notified that they are a challenged voter and they have resolved the challenge.
Right, but the statutes do allow for notification of people if they have a challenge status. For example, 201.061, that's the wrong one. The one that you're actually referencing beforehand does allow notification. 201.121 subdivision 2 provides notification if for example, they were mailed a ballot and it was returned back to them to let them know there's a residency issue here and you are now your status is now challenged.
But what happens under under the statute, first of all, that's for that particular challenge. There, the felons are not notified. The people under guardianship or trusteeship that have not been allowed to vote are not notified. There are many other things that make you ineligible. Other than that, Your Honor, that they are not notified under the secretary's process.
But once they get that registration, that covers all those things you're talking about. They have to certify that they're not on probation for a felony, that they're not ineligible to vote by reasons of guardianship, right?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. If you review the application, it does not mention probation. It does not mention probation. And that's one of our major concerns about utilization of the voter application to be that thing that weeds out ineligible voters. And that, Your Honor, could be the situation that we're talking about. Okay, you have a situation where somebody has committed a felony, they're out of jail, they're on probation, but the MVA application does not state that if.
But it does. It does refer to the felony sentence being expired, doesn't it?
But what does that mean to the average person?
So are you saying that the inquiry that occurs at a polling place under the Election Day statute is somehow qualitatively different?
Yeah, Your Honor, in the sample questions that were created by the secretary, they mentioned probation that could clear up that particular issue. Okay, so the secretary has already fixed that in election day challenge voting.
So it sounds like your problem is more with the registration form than with the roll potentially.
No, Your Honor, my problem is this: when you allow the ballot to be given to the challenged voter prior to the resolution of the challenge or notification of the challenge, it's like letting the cat out of the bag. The ballot is the extremely important thing that we all want to protect.
Right, but Mr. Erickson, even they're given the ballot, but they also have to fill out information to overcome the challenge. Are you saying that when it's sent in, it's automatically tabulated and there's no check or balance afterward? That's my
understanding, Your Honor. I don't think that like once they fill out.
But that seems contrary to 206.061, where it lays out the criteria for either mailing in that information or going to the same day and going before an election judge. That lays out the process where those ballots are reviewed, including the challenge status. Your argument seems completely contrary to.
Could you direct me to the
absolutely, absolutely. 206.061 on registration on or before election day. It's subdivision 3 and talks about election day registration and the ways that you can do it, including by mailing in the information to overcome your challenged status. Well, how about this, Ms. Erickson? Why don't I give you some time to take a look at that? And you can certainly address that on rebuttal. We have gone over quite a bit. We're actually approximately 30 minutes into the argument. So
I apologize, but can I just make one point before I misspoke earlier, and I think you're all painfully aware of this, but in Minnesota, the Supreme Court has found that absentee voting is a privilege, not a right. I said it backwards.
Right. Yeah. But okay. We understood what you meant. So
thank you. Not
a problem. Mr. Hartshorn, because I want to let you know, we went over about 15 minutes. We actually went 30 minutes. So if you need to have a little bit more time for your arguments, certainly feel free. We realize that this is a very, very important issue, and we want to give both parties a chance to explain their positions and answer our questions. So with that,
sure.
Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nathan Hartshorn. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and I'm here representing the respondent in this matter, Secretary of State Steve Simon. The two major points that I wanted to make are things that I gather from the questions that the court had from Mr. Erickson that the court actually understands fairly well. And so to some extent, the comments that I wanted to provide, and I think I still will mostly provide them, I may be telling the court things it already knows. If so, my apologies. Before I get there, I want to clean up a couple of things Mr. Erickson referred to. One of them is he cited Minnesota Rule 8210.3000, which I don't believe the petitioners have cited at any point in their filings. He quoted a portion of that rule that says no ballot may be mailed to a challenged voter, which if a rule that applied to this situation said that would be a big deal. However, that's a rule that does not apply to this situation. It's irrelevant to this case entirely. Rule 8210.3000 applies only to the mail balloting process in 204B45 and 46, which both the court and Mr. Erickson referred to at various points. As I think the court understands, the mail balloting process in 45 and 46 isn't what we're talking about here. That's not what the rule that's before the court applies to. So 8210.3000 is irrelevant to this case. I mean, maybe that and the mail balloting process more broadly are relevant as sort of an analogous comparison. Maybe I think the court has kind of been using it a little bit to that extent. That's fine. But as far as actual direct application to the facts we're talking about, it's irrelevant. 8210.3000 is irrelevant. And I don't understand what point there is in citing it up here. Certainly the specific text that Mr. Erickson read off is not true, is not correct as applied to our facts. Then Very late in his commentary, Mr. Erickson expressed unhappiness with the specific contents of the registration application, specifically what it says about the certification that the voter signs to prove that they are indeed eligible to vote. He would like to see something more, more explicit about probation, I guess. Well, the contents of that application are provided by statute. That's 201.071 subdivision 1. So if petitioners would like something different to be done with regard to the contents of that certification, with regard to the contents of the application, the place to go is the legislature, because because state statute specifically provides what's in that certification.
Mr. Hartzer, wanted to follow up on one question that Mr. Erickson made, and perhaps you can explain it to me. So, and Mr. Erickson can certainly speak to his argument better than I can. But as I understand it, what he's concerned about is the challenged process that occurs on election day, and that's different from absentee balloting. And I think Mr. Erickson is concerned that, well, you know, it should sort of be the same. So my question to you is, and I'm sure we all agree that, you know, we all want accurate counting of all eligible voters and not the counting of people who are not eligible to vote for whatever reason, either they're in the wrong district or they're a felon whose rights have not been restored, or they don't even live in the state, or, you know, they're 12. So what I'd like to get a feel for, Mr. Hartzorn, is, okay, so how does the Secretary of State, pursuant to the rule, ensure that the same sort of integrity that would occur on an in-challenge in-person election day challenge is the same when you send out a new absentee ballot? Maybe if you could answer that question, I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Well, I suppose the broad statement that needs to be made is it's not exactly the same. That this rule is an attempt by the Secretary of State's office, as I think the 1998 SONAR here explains. This is an attempt, this rule is an attempt by the Secretary of State's office to make the two processes, the polling place process and the absentee ballot process for dealing with challenges, to make those as close to the same as the Secretary's legal authority permits. Back then it was her, now it's him, to make them. So this rule was an attempt to create a hurdle for challenged voters who want to vote absentee that was as close to the hurdles 204C12 applies in the polling place as the Secretary could make them. They're not exactly the same, because the Secretary doesn't have the authority to make them exactly the same. And to some extent, there are just logistical limitations. There's no way to send out an interrogator to my living room when I'm filling out my absentee ballot and say, "You're challenged. Now I'm going to ask you questions under oath to see if you are eligible to vote." Those logistical limitations and the limitations of the Secretary's rulemaking authority prevent them, the two situations, from being exactly the same, but under the rule, they are as close to the same as the Secretary could make them. And I think the SONAR from 1998, which I think is the most important thing on the record.
Could you explain, Mr. Hartzorn, could you explain for the record, so that we all understand, just how similar are they? I mean, what are the similar safeguards, please?
One notable similarity, and I think Judge Gaitis referenced this, is that both under the 204C12 process and under the rule process, there's an oath. The voter is required to, in 204C12, it's a verbal or oral oath. And under this rule, it's a signed registration oath, under which the voter is swearing under penalty of felony prosecution that he or she is eligible to vote. And under the, you know, specific, at least under the rule, it's with a specific list of eligibility factors that are on the registration application. That's a similarity. Another similarity that specifically applies in the residence challenge context, it isn't quite so relevant to felony challenges or citizen challenges or whatever. But for residence challenges, when you register to vote along with your absentee ballot, you have to show documentary evidence of your residence to the to your witness, which is a third party, to prove, yep, this place I am voting from is in fact my residence. That documentary evidence of residence is evidence that the voter has to provide. In the 204C12 process, that doesn't necessarily involve documentary evidence. The person being asked doesn't have to pull out paperwork. I mean, I think ever, but they have to provide equivalent information testimonially. They are asked questions. If it's a residence challenge, they're asked questions about their residence. Hey, where do you live? What's your how long have you lived there? So on that are sufficient to test the person's residence. Those are the two main similarities that I can think of, that that the oath is there, and it's black letter law that the way Minnesota enforces voter eligibility requirements is by requiring voters to take oaths. We cite the federal district court decision that holds that in our brief. And so both situations require oaths, and in the residence challenge context, both processes involve the voter having to prove, in one case by documents, in the other case by testimony, that yes, this is where I live. Those are similarities. And to some extent, the SONAR explains the rationale that Secretary Groh and her staff had for structuring this the way they did. And that rationale from 1998, even though absentee ballot statutes have changed somewhat, they haven't changed in any way that makes the rationale they explain any less powerful, any less correct. Just as the court has done, I do want to address the petitioner's standing in this case and how the injury they're claiming is exactly backward for what the rule they're challenging actually says and what it actually does, as I've just been explaining. But before I do that, I need to respond to the representations counsel has just made. I need to explain what state law actually says about the supposed vetting process that petitioners have repeatedly referenced. And Judge Gaitas, one or two questions that you asked, I think, make it clear that you and quite possibly the court, you know where I'm going, but I'd like to go there anyway. The short version is that the plain terms of the absentee ballot statutes make it explicit that election officials are not legally permitted to do the kind of vetting petitioners are here demanding, the kind of 204C12 vetting that petitioners are demanding. Judge Reyes pointed out a particular spot in section 204C12 that cuts significantly against petitioners' argument, specifically that shows that 204C12 applies to polling places. There are two or three other things in 204C that add, that make that argument even stronger. But the incompatibility of what petitioners are claiming here is actually more explicit in the absentee ballot statute, specifically in MnSTAT sections 203B04 and 203B06. First, the backdrop of all this is section 203B02. That says that all eligible Minnesota voters have a statutory right to vote absentee. That's the general backdrop. And that's the rebuttal to the initial comment that here's the Minnesota Supreme Court saying that absentee balloting is a privilege and not a right. Well, actually it is a right. It's a statutory right under 203B02. But again, that's just the general backdrop. It's the specifics in sections 04 and 06 that block what petitioners want to change here. And I think the best way to illustrate that would be to provide a Minnesota voter who actually voted absentee. And for that, I offer me. Like more than a million other Minnesotans, I voted absentee in the 2020 general election. I'd like to run through the statutory process of how that worked to show how the vetting process that petitioners demand is contrary to law. Earlier this year, I filled out an application to vote absentee. I sent it to my local elections office, and because I live in Ramsey County, that's the elections office run by the Ramsey County Auditor. That's when we get to the first statute, section 203B04. Under subdivision 1B, when the auditor received my application, he had a mandatory statutory duty to approve it. The only conditions the statute permits are number one, that my application was timely, it was, and number two, that I filled it out fully, that I provided all the required information. And I did.
And Mr. Hartshorn, I just want to stop you there real quick. So when you're referring to 203B.04 subdivision one, that provision applies to people who have already registered to vote, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, well, actually not solely, because actually subdivision four then later addresses people who are not yet registered to vote. So actually, I mean, So the 1B that I'm referencing, if you put it together with subdivision four, it does apply to non-registered people.
Okay.
Thank you. If you leave out subdivision four, then it only applies to pre-registered people. And as it happens, I'm pre-registered. Also, challenged voters are by definition pre-registered, because if you haven't already registered to vote, you do not have a registration to challenge. So a new registrant, someone who hasn't registered before, can't be a challenge voter. There's no registration to challenge. But whatever, that's just sort of a terminological detail. So after the county auditor, the Ramsey County auditor, as a matter of mandatory statutory requirement, accepted my application, the statute gives the auditor another mandatory duty. Section 203B06, subdivision 3B, which I'm scrolling to here, says the auditor shall give me a ballot as soon as one is available. No exceptions, no conditions, no restrictions. The auditor shall send me a ballot. And he did, and I cast it, and that's how I voted this fall. Now, to the best of my knowledge, I am not a challenged voter. As far as I know, my registration is not subject to a challenge. But the whole point of this illustration is to show that under the plain terms of the statutory provisions I've just quoted, it wouldn't make any difference. Even if I had been a challenged voter when I applied to vote absentee, these same statutes would still explicitly mandate that the Ramsey County Auditor approve my application and send me a ballot. Under the law, the auditor is not permitted to apply some kind of vetting process. That would violate these very statutes. So if you change the hypothetical a bit, and let's say I am a challenged voter, let's say my registration has been challenged for residence because, let's say, after I voted in 2018, I moved from one apartment to another apartment. That's not true, but we're just changing the hypothetical. That is a very common situation. Someone votes and then moves, a very common situation that leads to challenges for residents. Under that situation, how does the statutory process I've just described, where I apply for an absentee ballot, the Ramsey County Auditor accepts it and then sends me a ballot, how would that change? The answer is not at all. Nothing in the statute allows the Ramsey County Auditor to deal with an application from a challenged voter any differently than from a non-challenged voter. So the statute, in so many words, blocks the kind of vetting process that the petitioners demanded. It's statutorily not permitted. And I think Judge Gaitis, in a couple of your questions to Mr. Erickson, I think that's what you were suggesting, and that's absolutely correct. Now, counsel, the petitioners, they want to apply the polling place interrogation statutes, 204C12, to the absentee process. The first and most obvious reason that that doesn't work is that 204C12 only applies to polling places. That's right. But we can even set that part of it aside. There's another fatal problem with using 204C12 that way, and that's which election officials it applies to. When you look at 204C12, there is only one kind of election official that's referenced there. Only one kind of election official gets any kinds of duties or responsibilities under that statute, and that's election judges. That's the only election officials that 204C12 has anything to say about. There's some private entities that are mentioned there, but as far as election officials are concerned, it's just election judges. Now, the absentee ballot process that I have just described, what role do election judges play in that? Answer, none. Election judges are not involved in that at all. I'm in Ramsey County, so my application goes to and my ballot comes from the Ramsey County Auditor, and 203B has several things to say about county auditors. If I lived in a different place, I think Minneapolis is an example, the whole thing would be done with municipal officials, like a municipal clerk rather than a county auditor, and 203B references them too. County auditors and municipal clerks, those are all specified by 203B as the officials that are involved in that and are bound by that. What does it have to say about election judges? Nothing, because they have nothing to do with that process. So 204C12, which has things to say, election judges shall do this, that, and the other thing, what relevance does that have to 203B, to the absentee ballot process? None. It's utterly irrelevant. And any attempt to use 204C12, founders for multiple reasons, one of which is it's only supposed to apply to polling places, the other which is on its face, by its plain terms, it only applies to election judges. And election judges have nothing necessarily to do with any element of the absentee ballot process, and definitely nothing to do with the process by which I get myself an absentee ballot. So 204C12 absolutely on its face, by the explicit terms of the legislature, cannot be used in the way that petitioners are demanding that it be used. As a matter of statutory text, their argument fails.
So, Mr. Hartshorn, I want to piggyback on a question that Judge Connolly had with respect to what then is the process for absentee ballots to vet challenged voters?
It's this rule. It's nothing but this rule. If the petitioners, and that's the next comment I want to make about how, as a matter of standing and the injury they've claimed, this petition is absolutely backwards. These folks claim that they um, that that they are injured when people, when challenged voters, some of which they suspect are ineligible, when challenged voters vote too much, when there is no controls on challenged voters voting. But in Minnesota law, as we've just seen, the absentee ballot statute provides no vetting, no check, no hurdle for that whatsoever. The only hurdle that exists in Minnesota law is this very rule, the rule they want to perversely invalidate, which makes no sense. They want to invalidate the very rule that it is the only thing in the law that prevents the injury they say they're suffering. It's as if these are folks who are worried about people screaming around on the streets at 100 miles an hour, so they file a lawsuit to try to strike down all speed limits. It makes no sense. The injury they are claiming for standing is something that this rule protects them from, and nothing else in the law protects them from. So what this rule does, and again, the SONAR from 1998 is the best place to go to explain how the Secretary of State Groh's staff was thinking about this. What it does is it says, I mean, based on the recognition that the secretary then had, and it's still true, that there's nothing in the absentee ballot statutes that provides any kind of analog, any hurdle that's at all comparable to 204C12, they said, okay, well, we need to create something that's at least a little bit like 204C12. So our rule, 8210.0225, says that when a challenged voter applies to vote absentee, that voter shall be treated for the purpose of the process. And Judge Reyes, the colloquy you had with Mr. Erickson about this is absolutely correct and on point. The absentee ballot process must be administered as if the voter was not registered to vote. And the reason that it's useful, as the SONAR puts in so many words, the reason that's useful is that it creates a new check on challenged voters voting that would not otherwise exist. By requiring that challenged voter to fill out a voter registration application, you're requiring them to sign an oath that says that they're eligible to vote, increasing the criminal penalties. If they're doing that falsely, they've just committed a state crime. And if this is an election involving federal offices, it's a federal felony too. And again, that's how Minnesota law enforces eligibility rules, by criminal deterrence. So by requiring this application, this registration application, that check is then placed on there. And then additionally, and especially relevant to the residence challenge context, the application process, when it is part of an absentee ballot application, that application process requires documentary proof of residence, which is an additional check on people who are, you know, sort of specially ineligible. They're voting in the wrong precinct, or Judge Connolly suggested maybe they're voting in the wrong state. That would be addressed by this. And that is the kind of check that the secretary determined was within his authority, his procedural authority, his rulemaking authority, to add to the absentee ballot context. And then just to back up a step, the fact that that's how this rule works, that's how it functions, that's what it's for, that's what it's intended to do, that context makes it clear that the petitioner's claim of standing is fundamentally incoherent. It makes no sense. The court has asked whether the standing claim the petitioners made here, whether it's speculative, whether it shows a mere possibility of injury, and whether it cites an injury that is special to the petitioners themselves as opposed to society. All of those are very legitimate points. All of those would be sufficient grounds for the petition to be dismissed for lack of standing. Those are good points, but frankly, the bigger, more fundamental, more severe problem with the standing claim here is they are claiming that having more absentee voting by challenged voters injures them. So they want to strike down the one and only provision in Minnesota law that makes that places any kind of restriction, any kind of check, any kind of hurdle in the way of exactly that kind of voting. They are asking to invalidate the one thing that protects them from the injury they're claiming. Fundamentally, that's incoherent. That makes no sense. And as a result, the most basic and the most logically primary grounds that this court can, and I would submit should, dismiss this petition is on the grounds that in light of what this rule actually does and what it actually says, their injury cannot possibly provide them with standing. That's what I have to say. As I said, I suspect the court knew the vast majority of what I've had to say. You knew where I was going, but it seemed worth saying anyway. If the court doesn't have any questions, then I can cede the remainder of my time.
I don't see any questions from my colleagues, so thank you very much, Mr. Hartstone.
Thank you.
Mr. Erickson, you have about 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I would actually like to begin by asking you a question, kind of a follow-up to Mr. Hartshorn's comments. Isn't the relief that you're seeking to invalidate this rule, wouldn't that lead to an absurd result? Because isn't this rule trying to fill in a gap that no. The legislature doesn't have?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is just like the secretary made this rule, okay, he can make another rule that mirrors the absentee voting process that occurs in cities of less than 400 people, which is the rule that Mr. Hartshorn said had no applicability. And that's 8210-3000. If the secretary just used that rule and the process that has already been authorized by the legislature for cities than less than 400 people, we wouldn't be here.
But Mr. Erickson, the question isn't what the Secretary of State should do. The only question before us is whether this rule the Secretary exceeded its authority by issuing this rule. The question before us is not what the Secretary should have done or could do.
I understand that, Your Honor, but what the Secretary is doing that is outside of his authority by this rule is changing the status, how a voter is treated by virtue of a voter electing to be an absentee voter versus an in-person voter. Okay, that same voter that Mr. Hartshorn says is a challenged voter. Okay, he's being treated differently by the secretary if he's an absentee voter versus an in-person voter, because he's forced to re-register again. Now, Mr. Hartshorn says
Mr. Erickson, I just want to stop you there, because what it sounds like that sounds like it's almost an equal protection argument, and that's not what I perceive from your briefs in terms of how that person is being treated. And the issue again is, how does this rule exceed the secretary's authority?
Where's the authority where's the secretary's authority to change the status of a voter?
But the status isn't changing. Mr. Erickson, the status of the voter is not changing. What is changed by the plain language of the rule is, it's not even a change, it's what process is used. There's no process right now for an absentee voter who's being challenged. And I think the sonar indicates at least four reasons, one of which is this appears to be a way for voters to fall through the cracks and the challenged voter not to be evaluated and vetted to determine whether or not that challenge status is legitimate or not.
Your Honor, first of all, I just want to go back to Mr. Hartshorn's argument that 204C12 doesn't apply to absentee balloting. I want to read to you from 203B.001, okay? It says that the Minnesota election law is applicable to voting by absentee ballot unless otherwise provided in this chapter, okay? The process by which challenged voters are dealt with has to be here, because it's certainly nowhere in 203B. It has to be 204C12, because it's it because basically what Mr. Hartshorn is saying is that the challenge process that is included in election day voting and in absentee voting and in cities in less than 400 people, the way that it's structured, being notified of the challenge status and resolving it, okay, is completely vitiated by making an application to vote absentee in a city greater than 400 people. Okay, what we are saying is that under the election laws in all these chapters, that's not what the legislature intended, and that exceeds his authority to provide that ballot prior to the challenge being resolved.
Judge Reyes, I realize the time has expired. I did have one final question for Mr. Erickson, if I could.
Yes, please, Judge Connolly.
Thank you, Judge Reyes. So, Mr. Erickson, I'm just trying to, once again, and I'll just state for the record, I'm not one of those average people. I think I'm below average. So what I'm trying to figure out is, I understand on election day how a challenge would occur, I think, and you tell me if I'm on the right track. So someone comes up to vote and I know they're a felon. And I say, wait a minute, he's a felon, his rights haven't restored, I challenge that. And then the process begins and questions are asked. What I'm trying to get a feel for, particularly what Mr. Hartshorn said, was how do you challenge someone who's voting absentee? I mean, how would that even occur?
What happens in cities than less than 400 people? Now, Mr. Hartshorn says that nobody is an election judge, okay, other than an election judge on election day. That's not exactly what the statute says. It says election official or their authorized representatives. And who's included in their authorized representatives, for example, Your Honor, is the city clerk. The city clerk who has access to the SVRS, okay, and can see the challenge status of the voter. That's who's acting.
No, but what I'm trying to get a feel is who is challenging the absentee voter? And we'll even go with your example, under 400, I just voted by absentee ballot. How does someone challenge that absentee vote? You know,
it's actually, Your Honor, how it's challenged is the city clerk. The city clerk looks at the SVRS when they see the request. Okay, they see the challenged. This is in the cities of less than 400 people. The city clerk sees the challenged status of the voter. Okay.
By whom? He sees the challenged status of the voter. How? Who has challenged that absentee voter? I mean, it's not the live person.
All voters that are challenged are notated on the SVRS.
How do you challenge?
If I may, Mr. Erickson, does the Secretary of State compile a list of ineligible voters and send that to the, I don't know who they send it to, but the city or the county?
Correct. That is basically the SVRS. It's a line item on the SVRS. It's checked challenged. And what happens is that when in the rule that I'm talking about, the less than 400 people statute, what happens is that the clerk sees the challenge status and does not mail them a ballot. She mails them a notice of the challenge, okay, And what the challenge is, and obviously some talk about how to resolve that challenge. And then once that challenge is resolved, then the ballot's issued. Our major problem with the process in 8210-0225 is that the challenge process, meaning whether on election day or by the clerk in this particular circumstance, that challenge process that allows the challenge to be addressed prior to the issuance of the ballot is what is being vitiated by this rule. Okay. That's our complaint, and that's what we're saying is outside the secretary's authority.
But you're referring to the rule for mail-in ballots. That is neither being challenged or argued that is contrary to the rule. It's the same day balloting statute that you're challenging with this rule. It's not an issue of what they should have done, but when I look at that rule, that is referring back to the processes and the checks and balances that exist in the absentee ballot statute. So, I just want to check to see if our colleagues have any questions. Mr. Hartshorn, it looks like you wanted to make.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the court would find it helpful if I just cited a couple of statutes that I think directly answer Judge Connolly's question. I don't have argument. I just want to point you to the two statutes that I think give Judge Connolly what he's looking for. Would that be helpful?
Sure. If you want to just cite those statutes.
Right. Judge Connolly asked where the challenge comes from, how it gets there. The answer to that is in MnSTAT 201.145, like three different subdivisions in that section. And then much less frequently, but very occasionally, 201.195. That's how the challenge almost always gets there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hartshorn. Mr. Erickson, I'll let you wrap up a summary if you would like.
Your Honor, all I'm going to just ask is that for the reasons in my argument, we ask that rule 8210.0225 be struck down as violative of the separation of powers and outside the secretary's authority. Thank you for your time. We appreciate the extra time. Obviously, everybody's read the briefs and this was a great experience.
Thank you very much, Mr. Erickson and Mr. Hartshorn, for your oral arguments and your briefing. Very well done, very extensive, and we appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe.